Welcome to The Pestle, reviewing and breaking down the movies to look for insights into the movie-making process. Hosted by The Chick and the Doc. Let's dim the lights and start the show.
Welcome, everybody, to The Pestle. Today's show is brought to you by The Thirsty Step. Grab a drink for a few schmeckles at The Thirsty Step. Welcome, everyone, to The Pestle. I am Wes.
And I am Todd.
And we're filmmakers, and we like to look at movies for the most part, every once in a while, TV shows, and then decide, you know, what's working, what's not working. We don't do that too much. That's a pretty rare thing for us to say, this isn't, you know, clicking for me. But it happens sometimes, and that's informative for us, not only in terms of what we like and what we don't like. And the cool thing about stories is discovering things that you gravitate towards and things that you don't, but also informative in the sense of, for me as a filmmaker, I'm constantly studying these things that great artists are doing, and how could I learn from that and implement it into my own work? And for me, some of the biggest things I've learned, you know, through doing the show has been like pacing, you know, how pros really pace a scene and how they implement dialogue in a way that makes it feel lived and breathed. That's one of the hardest things about acting and writing is making something you wrote and preconceived feel like it wasn't preconceived or written. Like these actors have to take these things and say these words in a way that feels like these are just two humans living life. And that's, it's, you know, to some degree an impossible task, but this is why everyone is so good at what they do. An actor is good at finding the humanity. And I've met plenty of actors who will not deviate from the script. They say what's written. If you want me to say something else, then you need to write something else. And that's so cool to me, just because I'm not that, I mean, I guess I'm that kind of actor, but, I'm not that kind of writer where I really care that much about my words being properly reflected. I want more of the natural, the messiness, the human stuff to pop out that I couldn't think of as a writer. You know, just even some of the ways that we pause and think about what we're going to say. And there's these weird transitions that happen all the time in conversation where you're in the middle of saying something and you pause and then you take a hard left turn. Like that's so hard to insert into writing, because as a writer, you're thinking about, I'm going from A to B and I'm just trying to get to B. And you forget that it can be messy sometimes, but sometimes it's also really good to go from A to B, because that's what your story's about. And we don't need to go to this other, you know, non-qualified topic. It's a hard thing as a writer to discern when to do those things and when not to do those things. And those are just, you know, fractions of the things I've learned from studying movies. I forget who said it, but it's like, you want to go to film school, the best thing you can do is, you know, pay $15 a month for Netflix, because you got so much education waiting for you right there. Yeah, I don't know. Have there been any takeaways or things you learned, you know, from what we do, just analyzing films?
Oh, man. I mean, I learn more questions than I think answers half the time. I mean, I think, you know, for the longest time, it was my biggest question was why does TV look like TV and film look like film? Why do movies look like movies and look like when you watch them, you think this does not belong on TV. There's a difference. And I still, you know, I've heard explanations, but I still don't know why. And I think that's just, maybe it's my ignorance or whatever. Maybe somebody out there can better explain it to a point where I'm like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And I can see that. But the problem is that if it was that well known what the reason is, everybody would do it. But I see, you know, well, you brought up Netflix. I see Netflix films. Why do so many Netflix films look like they do not belong in a movie theater? There's a difference. And what is that difference? You know, and there's probably 40 reasons why. Right. But, so yeah, I have that question. But a lot of times, when I look at movies now, I'm looking at a lot more nuance than I ever did before. You know, this film is going to be a good example of that. Cinematography is a big point of this film. I never really thought about it before doing the podcast. Huh. You know, I mean, it wasn't even a thing where bad cinematography would jump out at me. It was just the movie. It was part of the movie. Mm-hmm. But now it's a definitive aspect of it, right? Because it's your eyes. The camera is your eyes. And so things like that and types of acting, you know, whether that's dramatic or whether that's comedic or whether it's both at the same time, sometimes those things are just, there's so much nuance, right? And then also watching a scene and thinking about all the things that had to happen for that scene to go off without a hitch or for that scene to work, right? All of the people that had to be involved, all of the decision making, all of the timing, all of the gear, all of the prep, the makeup, the all of that is invisible in a good film, invisible in a bad one, and or in a challenging one. And I never really noticed that before. This podcast has just brought all of that to life and brought a whole new meaning to the term of, you know, the art of filmmaking for me, honestly, you know?
That's amazing. Yeah, my feeling, because that is always a fun question to tackle about what, why does TV look like TV and movies look like movies? Yeah. And to me, it's all about time. The amount of time you can invest in making a movie, like you can plan out and storyboard your entire film. I don't know if you're storyboarding an entire TV show. I just don't know that you have the time to do it. Especially back in the day, like recently, now it's more common to have a 10, 12 episode season. But for years, the standard was 20 to 25 episodes for one season. And you would make that in like 6 months. And great. For a movie, you might spend 6 months just thinking about how you're going to make your movie.
Yeah.
And then let alone shooting one scene could take 2-3 days. Like there's a scene in here where they're in a bar. I wouldn't be surprised if that took, you know, a solid 3 days to shoot. And maybe not. I don't know what kind of budget they were working with. The bigger your budget, the more you can do that kind of stuff.
It's A24. I'll bet they had a decent budget.
But for a TV show, I mean, you're turning that thing around. You're grabbing two cameras and you're going, what's our setups? And so you're not sculpting the lighting that much. You're not, and the pacing is so much faster in TV. Everyone's saying what they think and what they feel immediately. And then you're cutting straight to, whereas we get to ruminate. Like in past lives, right? We're going to contemplate for 3 minutes before a word is spoken. Like it's just going to be, oh, we're taking our time. We're embedded in these emotional undertones. TV, not so much of that. It's where we got, you know, 8 minutes to 12 minutes between commercial breaks and we need to make sure we get in there and then we leave you wanting more. And it's big dramatic things instead of we're working for one dramatic moment. They're working for like 20 to make sure you watch your commercials and come back. Because if not, you won't watch those commercials. You won't want to come back.
Yeah.
Makes sense. And yeah, so time, it's all about time to me. Whenever you can really take your time to think through all these big moments and how they all fit together in a puzzle-like fashion.
12 million, by the way. I just looked it up.
Damn.
The budget.
That's pretty low. Nice. Yeah, it is low, but also for a drama, man. Mm-hmm. That's not bad. I feel like the 5 million mark would be more common. If it wasn't A24 and she and Celine Song had to go and do this on her own, I bet she raises between 3 to 5 million at the most.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
But when someone like A24 comes and says, oh, we believe in you, what do you need to make this, to really make this? You're shooting in New York? That's expensive. Mm-hmm. But let's do it.
But this is also a case for spending less to get more, right? Because I think the box office, it says here, was 38.6 million. Man, you know, you instead look at a film like, I don't know, Killers of the Flower Moon. I think it was like $200 million or something to make. I mean, you have to make $600 million at the box office to triple your money as opposed to, you know, $38 million, which is triple the budget. Like, it's just insane. Now, you know, that's obviously a totally different caliber of film, totally, you know, it's its own thing, obviously. Yeah. You know, anytime you have Leo and you know, Bob on the screen, it's going to immediately be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. But It just, you know, we both just love this whole, like give us a few million bucks and we will make you a great story that you will triple your money. You know what I mean? And I think, yeah, just a good example of that.
It is. It really is. Because then on top of that, like A24 gives you your budget and they bring with it a great distribution system. Cause that's what they started out as. They're distributors who have then made their way into production. And having that kind of brand suddenly makes your project already profitable. As long as, and I'm sure they know their numbers, obviously, of what they can afford to spend and get a return or at least break even. And then it's like, okay, well, let's do that. And now we can put our name behind it because we believe in the script. And suddenly you have momentum. You can get Greta Lee, right? Who is headlining the film, and maybe she wasn't like a household name whenever she made this, but it suddenly it's like, okay, we have a little more cachet and then a little more cachet, and you just slowly, and now it's like press worthy. It's like, oh, what's A24 doing? Oh, they're doing this immigration. Oh, okay. What's that about? And you just slowly raise your profile through getting the right producers on board, who give you the right budget. And from there, you can just start to build out something, to give you a shot in this, you know, hellscape of, overconsumption. It's brutal out there, bro.
It really is.
Jeez. With that in mind, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so today we are covering Past Lives. If you have not seen this film, please pause this episode. Please pause it and go watch this film, because we're going to spoil a bunch of stuff, and this is not one to be spoiled.
I completely agree. We'll look at a lot of cinematography, to your point already. There's so much happening here with the cinematography. And so we'll look at a lot of that, a lot of long takes, and see what and why they're doing, you know, what they're doing to some degree or another, as well as some of the story and writing. Celine Song has a background as a playwright, which, you know, certainly informs Nora Moon's character. But I'm very curious, you know, about her writing. So I went and read her screenplay. We'll look at some of the notes that I took away from reading her screenplay, as well as talk about, you know, immigration as a theme and other such stuff and things and stuff.
And a quick synopsis of the film. Nora and Hae Sung, two deeply connected childhood friends, are wrested apart after Nora's family emigrates from South Korea. 20 years later, they're reunited for one fateful week as they confront notions of love and destiny. Written and directed by Celine Song. Cinematography by Shabir Kirchner. Featuring Greta Lee as Nora Moon, Na Young, Tao Yu as Hae Sung, and John Magaro as Arthur.
What?
It's just that you make my life so much bigger. And I'm wondering if I do the same thing for you.
You do. I'm just a girl from Korea, you know. You're forgetting the part where I love you.
I don't forget that. I have trouble believing it sometimes. You know, you only speak in Korean when you talk in your sleep.
I do?
Yeah. You never sleep talking English. You only dream in Korean.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You never told me that.
Most of the times I think it's cute. Sometimes, I don't know. I guess I get scared.
Scared of what?
Dreaming a language that I can't understand. It's like there's this whole place inside of you where I can't go. I think that's why I've been trying to learn Korean. Even though I know it's annoying for you.
You want to understand me when I'm dreaming?
Yeah.
So many good things. I'm curious. I have no idea. And watching this, knowing that you're going to watch it, kind of changes the way I watch it. Because I'm like, how is Todd watching this? And so I've had all kinds of, I don't know, weird ideas. And yeah, because you're married and you're able to watch this through a lens that I'm not. Yeah. And so, yeah. What do you think, man? Past lives, big story.
Yeah. So let me start off with, well, first off, yes, this is a great. I loved it. I really Yay, did. Okay. I thought it was amazing. Yes. Let me just start off with that. I only have one thing, and my one thing that I didn't like about it, that just was like a little tougher for me to reconcile, which was I felt like they were so young right at the very beginning. Like
12.
Yeah. I just felt like they were so young. I wasn't sure what was happening because I wasn't sure that, you know, this kind of thing was, how do I put this? I just wasn't sure how concrete this kind of like, you know, infatuation was, you know, like on their psyche. But then I remembered the time that it was, because I think that kids now are very different than they were in terms of relationships than they were 25 years ago. 25 years ago, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have iPads. We didn't have the internet, you know. Well, yeah, we didn't have any of that stuff. It was literally just who's in front of you, and that was your entire world. So when you met a girl that you were into, it was very heavy, right? But now it's different. Now it's like, okay, well, she doesn't like me. I'm going to go on my app and find somebody else, or I'm going to, you know, whatever. It's just different. And kids nowadays, I can ask my wife, because nowadays they don't start dating until later. Like it's crazy. They don't start driving until they're later. They don't, like, most of the kids at her school don't drive, and she teaches high school.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine that? Can you imagine being 16 and not wanting to get your driver's license? So, and it's not just that, it's also relationships. So then when I reminded myself, oh, we were different. Things were different back then. It became a lot more relatable and understandable. So it does, the film asks you to literally transport your mental state from 2024 to, or 2023, whenever this made, to,
99, 2000. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right. So it requires that you have to pay attention. You have to be in that time. You can't just be, I'm 2024 watching this happen. No, I've got to go back with them. So if I would have known that at the beginning, I would have watched it differently, but that's my fault. That's not the film's fault. The film is what it is, and you can go along with it or not. You know, that's the beauty of it. It's unforgiving, the whole thing. And I'm really glad you showed that scene, because I mean, that's the scene I related to probably the most, you know. I can say, you know, beyond just beyond the shadow of a doubt that, like, I've had those moments, you know. There are, I think we all have, no matter who we're dating or married to or in a relationship with, you know, there are parts of your partner that you can't, you will never visit. And in this case, the language is just the visible, it's for us. The language difference is just for us to be able to visibly see or hear, whatever, the barrier between them that he can't cross. But in reality, it's not necessarily that. It's literally time. There was a whole, and you know, we talk about this all the time. Oh, I think everybody talks about it. Oh, you remember before the pandemic? Oh man, that was like another life. Yeah. How many other lives do you have? Do you remember before 2011? Before 9/11? 2011. Before 9/11, that was another life too. Do I remember before kids? That was another life too. Like, we have so many past lives, and some of them are without your partner, and your partner has those without you. And I've had to, over the years, remind myself so many times that I'm an individual, that my wife is an individual, and she doesn't belong to me. I don't belong to her. Like, we are our own people. It was the way that I grew up. My parents are still married. They're married 53 years. It's crazy. That doesn't really happen very often, but that's my experience. My experience is you just are together now. You are the same person. That's what I was always told. So that's what I assumed. And that is not the case. You are not the same person. It could not be farther from the truth. It is literally the opposite of that. You become even more individualistic, and you have to recognize that. And it's a really interesting dynamic, this film, because, and I'm just speaking about it from the husband perspective right now. There's so much that I could say, and we'll get into it, I guess. But the husband, John Magaro, I don't know, he's been in other stuff, but he was fantastic in this film. I felt like I saw his emotion without him saying anything, just with him sitting in silence, which there's a lot of silence in this film, and I love that. But the way that he, in that scene, picks his words really carefully, but he's very direct. He's like, I'm going to tell you how I feel. And sometimes I have trouble believing that you love me. That's a hard thing to say to someone who has chosen to spend her entire life with you. She's every day she wakes up and she says, I choose you every day, every day. And yet it's hard for him to believe that still. It's almost like taking someone's flowers when they give them to you and throwing them on the ground and stomping on them. Well, that's how it probably felt to her. She's like, wait a minute, I'm here. I'm laying next to you. And you're saying that you find it hard to believe that I love you. Like, what, how dare you? You know, but he has to say it. He has to say it because of we need to hear it and she needs to hear it, but he's still saying it with love. And so he does a really wonderful job communicating that dichotomy of emotion, of fear. I'm sure there's an element of anger in this. There has to be, or he's not human. but at the same time, understanding and love and compassion for emotions. It doesn't hurt that he's a writer, right? That he, because like writers are more tapped into the nuances of emotion, and like it's okay to have that feeling, even though I hate that you have that feeling, you know, it's okay. And then the ending, I mean, we'll get to the ending later. I won't even talk about it right now. I loved it. I thought it was really slow rolling, and I loved all the silent, awkward moments that they had with each other, that Na Young had with Haesung. And I love the dynamic of the husband and him allowing them to talk in a language he didn't understand at the bar. And I also love that the film opened with that scene. How cool was that? Like, I developed a decision of what was happening in that scene by hearing the voiceover, watching these three people, and it was very different than what the actual movie turned out to be.
It's pretty cool. In the script, so that opening scene that you're describing at the bar ends when Nora looks into the camera, and then we finally cut away. And so that whole little sequence that's happening right there is them talking about, once we go finally catch up to that scene later in the movie, that's where they're just kind of meeting each other still, like, oh, you're in the military. How was that? Oh, it's hard mentally and physically and blah, 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 blah. And in the script, whenever we catch up to that scene, there finally comes a moment when Nora looks up. And then she looks at the couple who were having that conversation. Now, in the film, they don't use that. And we'll get to all that at some point. But, and I had to remind myself after I watched it for, you know, the umpteenth time to go back and like scrub through. I was like, wait, we didn't. Did we ever cut to that thing in the script? And so when I did, we don't. We don't cut to the couple on their date doing that whole conversation of, you know, making up stories for people that you see. But what we do is cut to a wide shot after Nora gets up and they have that conversation. And Nora gets up and walks away, and Arthur and Haesung are sitting at the bar. We cut to a really wide shot of that whole bar, and we can see the couple in the back in the dark. and they're still on their date and they're still talking to each other. And that's just a beautiful, random, well, maybe not random, but a little detail. It's there. There's so many layers in this movie, which to me is almost surprising because there's so few characters. And you would think with only three characters to flesh out, you know, you would kind of erase any of the extra layers. It would all just be laid bare by the time you got to the end of this. And yet there's still, you know, so many more layers left over. And I was melted. I mean, this whole movie melted me. I love films that are able to do that, to layer things in and not say everything that's on its mind, to leave all these undertones and let you live in the undertones and live with reading what's actually happening. What's the subtext? What's actually happening that's not being said? And this movie is full of that stuff. Now, they eventually do get to say most of it. There's still some things I think left unsaid, but understood, which is a whole other layer, like being able to get that across in a way that feels real and very undramatic. And it just pushes all the emotion onto you because the characters aren't really letting themselves go there. And it's just so incredible. There's not a lot of films that are able to do this, because talking about Arthur's, you know, John Magaro's character, like, and I feel like in most other films, he gets treated exactly. And I love that they, whatever, lampshade that whole idea of like, this is such a good story. I can't compete. How do I compete with this? Like, you know, old lovers from 20 years, we're not lovers. I love she keeps inserting and correcting him. Like, this is all in your head. You're a writer. Stop doing this. And also she's kind of amused by it, and because she's a writer too, and she gets what he's saying. She doesn't feel like, she's making sure my husband knows that this isn't reality, but at the same time, I'm a writer and I'll go there with, I'll humor him to some degree because it is funny. It's amusing, as long as we don't let it get too carried away where we start investing in this made up fiction that is just living in your head as my insecure, timid husband. And their dynamic is so good too, because they met at a writer's retreat. Therefore, obviously, they're both writers, but that dynamic that happens in that atmosphere is different from any other place you would meet someone. It's different from meeting someone at a bar and where you're trying to impress each other. At a writer's retreat, you know what you're doing? You're beating the hell out of each other's work. Like, you're critiquing each other. It's very laid bare, right? Or so I understand. And that's a different dynamic to start a relationship with. And so whenever you fast forward through 12 years of living life together, that never goes away because that's your foundation. And so they can have these really blunt, honest talks. That moment where she's discussing like what it was like seeing him. He's so Korean. Like, I know I'm Korean, but I'm like American Korean, but he's like Korean Korean. And to me, being around him makes me feel like I'm not Korean at all. And at the same time, more Korean? I don't know. And she's having this whole thought process in the background. And this is a great composition because Arthur is right in front of the camera and we're watching it. We're reading everything she's saying right on his face, and it's all insecurity. The more she goes and the more she's excited and, you know, rushing about it, the more he feels smaller and more insignificant. And it's so beautiful in writing, directing, performance. It's all fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And I love that the question he asks after she goes through all this, discussing really what's her story of immigrating to America. I mean, this whole thing is one big, and it goes both ways, but it's a analysis of what it's like to immigrate, you know, to another country. And this specifically is about America. And coming from Korea, that relationship is different from most other countries with America. But he hears all this, and instead of, you know, like, oh, what's that like for you as a husband? You know what the real question is? Are you attracted to him? Like, is he attractive? It's so honest, and he's so crestfallen when he says it. And what's so good, because it speaks to the relationship and the foundations of the relationship, is that she answers him honestly.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't say, no. I mean, he's not really my type. She doesn't do any of that BS. he would know, first off. But I think most couples probably do that anyway, because it's the right thing to say and you don't want to spur insecurity. But their working relationship has always been about going right after your insecurities. And whenever you're that comfortable, you can have an honest conversation and say, yeah, you know. But yeah, he's masculine. She starts describing everything this guy's clearly not.
Yes, exactly.
And for him, it just highlights his insecurity, when in reality, if you could be, and you just can't, but if you could be objective about it, you would understand she's only comfortable saying that because she doesn't care, because she's not actually invested in it. It's when people start hiding how they really feel, that's when you should actually be concerned. And that is just hard to cope with in the moment that you're hearing about this ex-military engineer who's masculine and, you know, so much more assured of himself. He's like, oh, yeah. And he's just super insecure and he's probably never seen a weight room in his life.
Definitely not.
Oh, yeah. How did you make of their, that whole dynamic between Arthur and Nora, and then, you know, inserting Hae-sung in the middle of that, and seeing that all kind of bubble up?
Yeah, it's, I completely agree with you that, first off, it's their type of relationship. They're writers, they're honest, they're, you know, open and everything. And while I think that that's awesome, there are some things that change everything forever. And I think that sometimes even honesty can do that. I'm not telling people to lie. I'm not saying that. But I do think choosing words in sensitive situations is everything, right? So the way that you respond to that question of, are you attracted to him, is not the way that she should have responded. She can say the same thing in a delicate way when she looks into his eyes and, you know, she's just like brushing her teeth or, like, I don't know, putting on lotion or something. I don't know. And she's like, I don't know. Yeah, I guess, you know, yeah. Uh-huh. Or I don't know. Yeah. Saying these things, that's not the way to deliver that. I feel like to somebody like this guy, like Arthur, especially, I think that it needed to be more supportive when the honesty is given. Mm-hmm. And to your point, though, you know, if she sees no kind of danger in telling him and just, you know, speaking her mind, then of course she's going to be that way and she's going to deliver it however she delivers it, how she would normally deliver any kind of answer to a question, because it's just whatever. But I don't think that it's that. I think that she does. It is a past life. She does still probably have some residue there. And she is lying by not protecting Arthur when she's giving him that news, because there is something, there is more there, and he can sense it. He knows it, you know, like, and I know it too. That's the beauty of this acting. It's like, she's incredible the way that she delivers it, and he's incredible the way that he receives it. And we see him in the moment that she starts talking about the Korean, you can see his whole self. He's like pouring water. And you can see his whole self start to slowly kind of fall just down.
He's wilting.
Yes. He literally wilts over the span of about 30 seconds or 20 seconds, but it's not immediate. Mm-hmm. It's just like, I think he's like drinking or something. And he just pauses for a second and, you know, and then he lets her keep talking. 'Cause why would I stop this? I'm getting the truth. And then, the way that he receives the information and the way that she delivers it is beautiful and just so, I guess it tells a story right there. And then that leads them into the scene, I think, that you, doesn't it lead them into the scene where they're in, that you showed where they're in bed? Yeah. The acting is just fantastic in this film. So I think all around, I think, what's his name? Hae-sung, Tae-yu. I think he does an incredible job too, because he needs to be non-invasive. He needs to be someone where we as a viewer can see Arthur trying to be amicable with and trying to love in a way, because he gave joy to Na Young when she was a child when she was another self. So he's trying to, he's inviting him in. He's like inviting him to his house and saying, let's go get a drink and paying for it. And like all of the, he's like, I want to learn your language. I want to be a part of this other life that I cannot touch. And so I'm welcoming this guy into my life too. And so he has to be not, Heisung has to be this kind of not aggressive, very, kind and meek, kind of persona, so that when he does get up the guts, especially when he gets up the guts in the bar scene to just talk to her, he's like, F it. I'm just going to talk to you, with him sitting right there. When he started doing that, I was like, oh my God, what's about to happen right now? You know, are these two nerds going to go at it? Like, what's up? But Arthur just lets them talk, which I felt was weird and awkward. But then they get that moment afterwards where they just talk together, which I think was totally necessary, completely necessary. So yeah, anyway.
Totally was. And there's a great line because you nailed it. You absolutely nailed it whenever they're in the bar. And he finally just decides to go for it. There's a kind of an aside in an action line where Celine Song says, so Heisung says, I had found my first love after 12 years and I shouldn't have let her go. Thoughts like that. Nora doesn't know what to say in response to that. Heisung doesn't know if he'll ever see her again. So he pours out everything that's been on his mind and floods the space between them. What a beautiful... God, you're giving your actors so much to work with and admitting like, hey, this is it. This is the moment. Open up as much as this character is ever going to open up. This is going to be it. And I love that. It's so obvious. It comes across so well that it's almost like you read the script. Like it's just great directing and obviously writing, but performance. Like for him to your point, like he has to carry this whole persona that makes that feel significant. Because if he comes across too confident and too big, it starts to lead you astray about where this film is going. Like,
great point.
He has to carry kind of a leading man energy without being the kind of stereotypical leading man, because he is our lead, but he's also not the chosen one. It's a great character to write, but it's also a fine line to walk. And I love that, you know, this is not the story that just goes the direction that you think it's going to go. And they do, Celine Song does a wonderful job of letting you wonder where it's going to go, if it's going to go there, without making you feel betrayed that it doesn't.
That is excellently put. Yes.
And that's why you have to have Arthur speaking that out loud. He has to put his thumb on the scale to give voice to the viewer's thoughts of the normal way this goes is the evil American white dude gets left behind. And it's so important to have those scenes with them together as a couple. But that scene in bed makes you feel okay, because without that, imagine you delete that scene from the movie. All the screen time is really between Heisung and Na Young. You know?
Yeah.
You need time with Arthur and Nora and to see their relationship together, but also that it's good and that it's deep. And it's just as deep, if not deeper, than what she has with Heisung. And those little moments are so honest and raw and full of emotion that you suddenly you feel okay with that. And the other thing that I think she does is towards the, you know, at the very beginning of the film, the mother is talking with Na Young, and she is asking, like, who do you like at school? She thinks, and she has that little flashback memory of being together in class with Heisung, and he's like drawing on her hand or something. And we flash forward and she's like, yeah, it's him. I will probably marry him. That's what she says. I will probably marry him. And that's such a good thing, because now you're setting an expectation and it satisfies a need to put them together by kind of letting us imagine them coming together. and also creates an expectation to upset. And it's not until we get into that scene with Arthur in bed that we know that's not happening. That is off the table. And so it also creates a whole tension throughout the film for we're expecting them to come together. And so you're able to set it up with the line, I will probably marry him, and also take it down with Arthur's analysis of their relationship, which fits perfectly because he's a writer and he thinks in writing terms. And so it doesn't feel like you're breaking the fourth wall talking to the audience because it's so endemic to the world that's been built. It's just genius, genius storytelling, I think. Yeah, sorry, you're going to jump in.
No. I just love what you're saying. It's such great storytelling, honestly.
God.
So, yeah.
And the other thing, you know, that's really satisfying is watching how they grow apart and how Hae-sung is not able to go there with her. He doesn't see it, or he does, but he's constantly trying to pull her back to being Na-young instead of letting her be Nora.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
there's that moment when they first reconnect.
Great way to put that.
You know, and they jump on Skype for that first time, and he's just there. Whoa. You know, that's a beautiful moment of reconnecting with someone you haven't seen in a long time. And she tells him, like, oh yeah, I've changed my name, you know, to Nora Moon. He's like, that's why I couldn't find you. And he asks her then, can I just call you Na-young? She's like, of course. But nowadays, not even my mom calls me Na-young. Hae-sung never stops seeing Na-young. He never lets the old version of her go. And even in that call, he's asking her, you know, do you still want to win a Nobel Prize? And she's like, well, what? No, actually, now I got my eyes set on the Pulitzer. You know, you never change. You know? And then you fast forward again another 12 years, and they're in New York, and they're about to go see the statue. And they're in line. He's like, hey, so what are you into now? What is it? You know, she's like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, you used to want a Nobel, and then you really wanted the Pulitzer. What do you want now? She's like, honestly, I haven't thought about it. Well, think about it. What do you want? I guess now I'd want a Tony. To her, it doesn't matter. It's not who she is anymore, but he's forcing it on her. He's like, well, no, think about it. And then what does he say after she says that? That she, you know, a Tony maybe. And he's like, it's you. You never change. I was like, no, you're missing it.
You're missing it, dude. I love that shot, by the way. It's one of my favorite shots in the whole film. Just with the boat behind them while they're standing in line. There's like so much depth even behind the boat in that, and so much depth in lighting. They're really dark, but you can still make out a little of the color of his blue shirt, and like there's the white boat behind them. I don't know how you light for that. Like, that's gonna be really difficult. Or they had to shoot this on film, right?
Yeah.
That's why, right?
It's gorgeous. Can pull so all those highlights out, down. Probably overexpose it by a stop if you want, maybe two. And then you still save all those highlights for, you know, post, but still get a lot of detail in those shadows, while still creating a ton of contrast. Like, it's gorgeous. Film allows you to do some stuff.
And to your point about why film is different than TV, I think here's another good example that I noticed, like, and I'm watching it while you're talking too, going to these scenes you're talking about. I'm like, oh yeah, and that. And, when it gets to, when he meets Arthur, and that whole just awkward first 5 seconds where you're just waiting for Arthur to do something. And then he just slowly smiles and you're like, oh my God, this, by the way, Arthur's, he's so good in that scene. Then are you hungry? They leave. As they're walking, Arthur is between them. As they're walking, this is the difference. Yeah. The blocking of all of this stuff is like really, really part of the story. So Arthur's standing between them as they're walking. He's, you know, watching them talk. And then at dinner, Arthur's sitting across from Hae-young Hae-sung. But Hae-sung and Na-young are sitting together, or Nora are sitting together on the same side. So that brings them closer together. And then at the bar, she's in the middle and he's on the outside. So slowly whole scenario of them going out together brings Nora and Hae-sung together, so that they can have this conversation, have this moment, right? And then when Arthur and Hae-sung are talking in the end, there's that empty seat between them. All of this like goes, it's really like kind of subconscious, but you know, you feel it, you know, rather than notice it, unless you're in a podcast trying to talk about it, right?
Absolutely. So. And I love, that's such a good point. I didn't think about it until you're just talking about it in terms of Arthur's right there in the middle, because it is doing everything you're talking about. It's giving a way to progress the relationship through composition and blocking. But the other thing is it feels natural too, because Arthur is trying to make an effort to get to know him. So he wants to be next to him. But because of what you're talking about, the progression aspect of bringing them together, Heisung and Nora, you block it a little differently, because you could have put Heisung in the middle between them. But then you're invading the space that you're talking about. So instead, put Nora on the other side of Arthur. And now we can show that Arthur is really making an effort here while giving space to allow them to slowly come together and crop out Arthur on the way.
Yeah, I mean, they had to think about the blocking of the dinner.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that really like got me. And when I first watched it, I noticed it right away. I was like, okay, if I was in this scenario, it's kind of, okay, normally when you go out to dinner with your girlfriend or wife or whatever, you sit across from each other. You're not...
Right.
You know, okay, let's say you're in a booth. You're one of those couples. You sit next to each other. That's weird. You know, whatever. But normally you're at a two top or three or four top and you're sitting across from each other. Mm-hmm. So you can talk to each other. In this scenario, it's like if they were normally, I would sit next to my wife and whoever was with us would sit across the table. Right. That's normal. But in this scenario, they didn't do that because what Arthur, they're trying to show Arthur making an effort to allow Nora to reconnect with Heisung. So he's allowing them, Arthur is allowing them to sit next to each other. He is letting this go, which it highlights the next scene where they're in the bar and he's allowing them to now talk together. It's just so, so well thought out how they block this thing. And if you don't think about it, you just feel it. It's so great. So,
it's so great. I mean, the whole movie is paced to perfection. It's really dicey to do some of the things they're doing in terms of allowing that much space without it feeling like a drag, which also means, I mean, this doesn't run 2 hours. I could see a version of this where they're in the editing room and it runs like 2 hours, 20 minutes, like where they're just like, oh, this is... And so finding a way through good writing, which is where it started, and also really good blocking and cinematography to allow the performances to not just come to life, but also to reduce the amount of editing that you're doing that allows it to feel more evenly paced instead of feeling like jumpy and you're exhausting the audience. This is a slow moving iceberg of a film and really iceberg, you know. Everything is underneath the surface. And so you want to make sure you're not pushing the tempo in a way that's going to work against the actual tone of the film. And so finding a way to reduce the amount of cuts and also, you know, heightening when you decide to make those cuts is really tricky. And so there's a lot of long edits where we're hanging out on a frame for a really long time. Sometimes there's only one frame and a scene and that's it. There is no coverage. And so what do you do? Now there's a lot of ways to do that and depends on your film. One way is to just lock it off and let it happen. The way they did it in this film though, is there's a lot of little camera movements to keep visual interest during those longer cuts, like very slow pans and pushes, just to keep it like interesting and to keep you engaged with the film so that, you don't feel bored or it doesn't feel tedious, because that also allows, if you're doing that, if you're panning and pushing, that also means you're closer into the action. Whereas if you weren't, if you're going to capture that whole scene, you would go wider and allow the audience to pick where they're looking. And there's pros and cons to that depending on the story you want to tell, of course. But here, there's so much more emotion and stuff to read on people's faces. You want to be closer. And so that's a big decision to decide, okay, we're going to go close, you know, mediums. We're not going to do a lot of wides. When we do wides, you'll know we're doing a wide. But instead, we're going to go close and then we're just going to pan and sometimes zoom, sometimes push. And that'll allow us to get in close enough to see people's reactions and gauge their emotions. And then we'll guide them instead of editing through panning, and we'll just move around so that we can still get a sense of coverage without ever actually inserting cuts. And this will give actors a lot of, you know, time to work through a scene and to, and the nice thing about all of this, you know, just keep in mind, Celine Song is a playwright. She's used to pacing a scene. Plays are all about that. It's all about finding rhythm and moments and pauses and ways to engage with the audience throughout, you know, through lack of cuts, right? Obviously, in theater, no cuts. You get like two cuts if there's three acts, and a lot of plays are two acts and one act. And so it's all about figuring out a way to pace a scene and find rhythm with minimal, you know, blacking out or dropping the curtains. And so she's obviously a built-in expert in this stuff. And so looking at a few scenes, Hae Sung is at dinner with his friends and he's talking to them about, I'm about to go to New York. And his friends are giving him, you know, shit like, oh, you're going to go see that girl now that you've broken up with your girlfriend? And he's like, what girl? Man, don't act like you don't know who I'm talking about. Oh, yeah, I guess I might see her or whatever. Like, so there's that whole thing unfolding. And then it ends with, you know, his buddy like, oh, you're screwed, man. It's raining the entire time you're up there. And the way we cover that scene is a slow pan around. Instead of doing coverage and cutting, you know, it's so much more visually interesting without adding rhythm to the film. And also, it's probably easier to shoot. It's one big setup. You film it, whatever, 10 takes, and then you move on to the next deal. And so you can spend more time setting up that shot, adding little visual interest pieces, you know, lighting it. Hey, let's add a splash of light over here. And how do we want to start and end the scene? Well, we'll probably want to move around this table a couple times slowly. We're going to pan around. And then it just, as you're working through the scene, through the blocking and just start running takes, you can start experimenting because you don't need continuity. It's all one take. Experiment, throw caution to the wind and say, you know what? Let's do one more, except this time start here. And we've been starting here. Maybe start here instead. And that'll give us somewhere to go. Like it's just it's so good. I don't know why, you know, this didn't win, or at least I don't think it got nominated. Like Chabier should have had a nomination. This is like incredible filmmaking.
Like, especially like the long shot of them under the bridge. Their walk, I was just blown away. I was like, where is this going? Oh, it's just going here. Amazing. And the blocking that they had to do on across the water on the carousel, you know, because you're shooting 200 yards away or 100 yards away, but somebody has to be over there at the carousel, like wrangling all of the people and telling somebody to walk this way and that way and all that stuff. And but it's all one shot, the whole thing. I don't know. It's like, 3 minutes. But anyway, it's just so beautiful the way that they plan these like long oneers. And then the one at the bar of them, the two men talking, there's this slow, literally the slowest camera move I've ever seen. It's just like so slow. If you're not paying attention, you will not see it. You'll just feel it. It's so well done.
So well done.
Just like a playwright would do, I feel like. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that scene you're talking about with the bridge and the park, my jaw dropped in the theater when I saw that. It was just, it's a gorgeous wide. And I'm like, in the moment I'm waiting for us to cut into the coverage and we just hang out there. And then we slowly crane down to pick them up into a medium and then pan over, track with them to reveal the skyline of New York. Like, what the f- is this? This is what? Like, it's just so freaking immaculate. Yeah, it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
Same thing with that scene we talked about earlier, Nora and Arthur getting ready for bed. Just a beautiful composition that allows us to see everything. We're able to see Nora because there's a mirror that she's brushing her teeth into. So even when she's facing away from the camera, we can still kind of see her. I mean, she's not in focus, but there's enough there to read. And even if not, like her energy is enough to tell you everything that's happening. But more importantly, we get to see Arthur because we don't spend that much time with Arthur throughout the film. It's important when we're there with them, if we're going to create a three-dimensional character, to be able to see how he's reacting and handling everything. And every time Arthur's in the scene, we really spend a lot of time focusing on what Arthur's experiencing so that we never forget about him as a major character. So even when he's not talking, we're seeing, we're engaging with him on an emotional level. And that helps, once again, give a rightness to Nora staying with him instead of feeling betrayed, because we engage, we like Arthur. We know Arthur. We know how he feels. And he's not a jerk. He's not this jealous husband who's stamping around, you know, saying, no, you sit on my side of the booth. I'm your husband. Like, he's not that guy. Like, he's insecure, but he also doesn't let it rule his emotions in a way that impedes on the rest of his life. And so another scene is that with Arthur, that long exchange with Arthur in bed starts with this kind of awkward angle of them together in bed. And what I love about this shot, and I do love it, it's a great shot because it's flat. It's kind of flat. There's not a lot of depth to it. It's a little underexposed, so there's not a lot of detail in the shadow or saturation, right? It's all kind of just blue and muddy black. It's so boring. It's a really boring shot. And it reinforces the whole thing that he's talking about. His view that their life together is very plain, very ordinary, very uninteresting. We only got together because we were single at this retreat. And then, you know, we moved in together to save on rent. And then we got married because, you know, your green card was about to expire. Like, you know, this is our story. And it's reinforced right there in the cinematography by making it as uninteresting as possible. But as he actually goes into the details of their story together, he's saying all the things that now makes their relationship special. Would you have gotten together with me, or would you have gotten together with someone else if I wasn't there, if I didn't like all your same movies, if I didn't give you feedback on your plays, if I didn't, all these things that make us us. That's when we move into coverage. This is such a beautiful edit because now there's depth. And there's this beauty. There's all these textures that are now coming to life. It's not flat at all. He can't see it, but now we can, because this is new to us. We don't know. He already had watched Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And that was, you know, Hae-sung had to go watch it. He didn't know, like, what's that movie? And it's cool that he went there. Dope. But all these details, what? Yeah. But this is the life I chose. I ended up here because this was the where I was supposed to be. Like, to her, that's a good thing. And whenever the way she says it, though, it doesn't feel like a good thing. And it's such a beautiful way to cover that scene. And it's great. I'm sure it's there in the cinematography, but it goes hand in hand with the editor. The editor saw this. He's like, I see what y'all are doing and I'm going to play into it. Probably at worst, Celine Song comes in and says, no, let's hang out in this opening wide establishing before we go into coverage. But I bet the editor saw it first, where he's like, oh, no. This is plain. This is boring. This is beautiful. This is deep. And he's just choosing those moments of when to use the coverage, because it speaks to the story that's being talked about on screen. It's really wonderful. Again, all the way around, the editing is tied into the cinematography, which is tied into the writing, which is all, you know, supported by the performances. Just, God, greatness. Okay, my last cinematography note, I think, is them at the bar, that wide shot of all three of them together at the bar, which is great. So it's a really long take, and I love that because it allows for a much messier scene. Again, you're not worried about continuity. So what can you do? You can now trample each other's lines and add a lot more naturalistic language to the film. Like, yeah, okay, this is John's line right here, but Greta doesn't need to respect it in the same way if you're trying to get clean audio. Greta can now just jump in and like, yeah, what's that? As he's talking over, you're still talking, okay. And then he can finish his line. Like, that's so much more cool and interesting because it's real. And you're letting all your actors play in the same sandbox together. And finding moments to let that happen is really good. Because if you're not, which that's, I mean, personally, my tendency is to not get too carried away about clean lines and dialogue. And I just create those headaches for myself in post. But I like it because I know whatever happens in post, it'll be supported by my actors going to the places that they need to go instead of me trying to wrangle them in and force them into a corner that then maybe I can make feel naturalistic in post. Like, that's backwards, man. Let your guys go. Like, you got horses in the race. Well, let them run, man.
Yeah, man.
And that's such a good one. And it's great compositions, right? It goes back to what you were saying about that progression through the scenes of that night out together. Because now she's in the middle. And it allows you to, once you go from this wide, we can frame her at the spot. When we go into coverage, she's framed with Arthur in a two-shot. And then we slowly pan over and frame her with Hae-sung. And then we start moving into coverage with just Hae-sung and Nora, and cutting out Arthur before finally we see Arthur in like this, I think it's a dirty single, where we see a little bit of Nora, right? And that just is because he's still there. He's emotionally invested with her. And I think that's the usually the best way to use, you know, dirty coverage, is to imply what the person you're looking at is thinking and feeling about the person who's in or out of coverage. Nora's in a little bit in the scenes because he's connecting. He's trying to connect with her. Whereas if you shoot Nora without any dirty coverage of Arthur, it's because she's disconnecting with him. And not to say that that's always what's happening here, but that's a good way to use clean and dirty coverage, is to imply what a character is thinking and feeling about the person that should or should not be in the frame with them. Yeah. Anyway, that's my cinematography notes. If you have anything to add, by all means. I got a few more notes here to run through, though.
The only one that I think I'll call out is, I think, an additional one to that scene where they're laying in bed. We'll just keep coming back to that, because I think that for me, that resonates so much. They do this random cutaway of Hae-sung with him in his hotel room, and it's just a pan where we see him, and then we pan to the window, and we see his reflection. And I think that's such a good way to show that he's in her past, right? Like, so this conversation that's about to happen, where Arthur is insecure and he's laying it bare to her, and she's trying to reassure him, you know, like tells us, look, he is in the past. This is a reflection of her past, but not her present. And I think for me, and what you were saying just a second ago, like so resonated with me about him in his depiction of how just matter of fact they got together was the beauty of how they got together. A million things had happened. She had to move from across the world and exist for 12 years in a way that allowed them. And she had to reconnect with Hae-sung for a while to disconnect with him, to then go to this retreat to me. Like, all of these things had to happen. And it reminds me of like all the things that had to happen that fucking sucked for me to meet my wife, and all the things that have happened since that have been so wonderful and that have been difficult and that have led us to here. And now I live in freaking, you know, California. I don't know how this happened. I don't know how any of this stuff happens. And yet it all had to happen in that way for me, you know, to be here, for us to be here. And how beautiful that was of him saying that, like, what if this and what if that? Actually, yeah, that's the point. That's exactly the point. And she's chosen you. And she says, you forget about the fact that the point about me loving you. You know, she doesn't love Hae-sung. You know, there's a part of her past that belongs to him, though. And that's what Arthur is having a problem with. And our own worst enemy forever in our lives as human beings is our memory. It is the thing that will bring us either the most joy or the most pain, is our memory and what we choose to do with it. Right. And you can take a memory like this and you can choose to love it for what it is, a memory, or you can let it devour you. Right. And I think that at this moment, Arthur is allowing it to devour him instead of allowing it to be his single biggest point of joy. And, you know, that's not what this movie is necessarily about, but that's what I take away from it, is like, okay, we all are human beings. We have experiences. We have memories. We have past lives. How are we going to let that dictate our now? Because our now is all we have. And he chooses in the end, Arthur chooses in the end, to embrace his now, his wife, who also has chosen to embrace her now by letting go of that past, right? And he could be mad about it, but where is that going to get him? You know, it's not going to get him anywhere. And now their life together, I'm sure, like in my mind, is better than it was before, because she knows she can be who she is with him and that he will accept her and through all of the discomfort and be there to hug her when she comes out of it. You know, like that's just unbelievably beautiful. And what a message. This is like an incredible film.
It's so amazing because normally it's pretty normal for a movie to have a metaphor for whatever the plot is. And in this case, it's two metaphors, or at least one that can go either way. Like their love story is a metaphor for immigration, while also immigration can be a metaphor for relationships. Like it's so amazing. It just depends on how you want to experience this movie and what you're bringing, you know, to the table. So like immigrating, right, is leaving behind an entire world, culture and friends. I love at the beginning, Haesung's mom, whenever they're at the park on their date, and the parents are talking, and Haesung's mom is like, You're an artist, you know, your husband is a film director. Why would you want to leave? And Na Young's mom is trying to think of a way to explain it. And she's like, if you leave something behind, you gain something too. That's kind of the best that she can like hope to explain. Like, yes, we're leaving something behind, but we're getting something too. And that works, whether you're talking about immigration or you're talking about love, friendships, almost anything in life, you know, you can apply that. And that's this whole story is about leaving something behind and what you're gaining from leaving it behind. The whole Newton's third law kind of concept. And that's Nora's story. It's her leaving behind, you know, Korea and her childhood, which is Haesung. Haesung is a representation of Korea for her. And it's her making a decision to become whatever, American or Canadian or Canadian American, or figuring out a way to be all three and be okay with that. Whew. It's really wonderful. And so tourism is so freaking fantastic because it plays into the very aspect that the whole immigration theme is embedded through the use of tourism when, you know, Haesung comes to town, because now they can kind of look around, go see stuff. And so what do? They, of course, you go see the Statue of Liberty. That's immigration one of Ellis Island. I mean, that's the whole history for a good chunk of, you know, America. And the whole melting pot idea is Ellis Island, Statue of Liberty. Bring me your poor and your tired. Like, it's right there into the film. It's playing right into the heart of the themes of this story. And I love, love, love that Haesung and Nora have both seen the Statue of Liberty. But you know who hasn't?
Arthur.
It's not important to him the way it is for them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, it's wonderful, you know, and it's easy for an American like you and I watching this and to miss that whole massive aspect of immigration as the heartbeat of this film. Because for us, it's not that important in terms of impact on our life. Like, we've certainly known plenty of immigrants, but at the same time, we don't know what that experience is really like because someone in our history did that for us. And we just grew up existing in America, or in our current culture. And I, in hindsight, I wish I'd grabbed, you know, someone who had immigrated. You know, that would have been a really fun conversation. Like, bringing Sergio back would have been a really fun, one for this. And then I'm kicking myself for missing that opportunity to hear, you know, someone else's experience watching this film as an immigrant, or someone, you know, that's knows what it's like to, you know, have those kinds of experiences growing up in a culture in America that is, you know, rooted in something else. Like, that's really cool and fascinating. It's one of the things that makes America incredible. And so, but they use immigration in the film too, in another way. Whenever we flash forward 12 years. And I love that. I love that she meets Arthur and they kiss. And then we immediately cut and jump 12 years ahead. Because that edit tells us so much. It's like a and they lived happily ever after kind of moment where movies normally end, right? The movies always end with the kiss, you know, save the kiss for the end. And here they use it as an ending for that moment of her life. And now we Cut to 12 years have passed. And how do they catch us up? We go to immigration once again. And now we're in customs. And it's a really simple way to layer in some exposition because you have a guy literally at the counter asking questions that the audience needs to know. What were you doing in Canada? We were visiting her family. We were visiting her family. Oh, y'all are together. Are y'all together? What's y'all's relationship? We're married. Oh, okay. Well, everything we assumed happened in that blackout actually happened, confirmed. And what's pretty cool too is the script had even more details. They went into a little bit more of like, oh, we're writers and you know, that kind of stuff. And they cut it out of the film, which I think was the right call, because we don't need to know that. We're going to figure that out. Leave some detail, something else for us to learn, in these upcoming scenes, because you're just reinforcing it at that point when you don't need to. So cut that part out. We'll figure out what they do because that's there. It's there. Leave us something to engage with. It's really good. And the other thing that I really love, is there's so much happening between the lines. Whenever they do meet at the retreat and she's telling him about Inyun, which is important for the story. This whole story is all about, you know, what's happening in your current life and things that bring us together. And she's giving Arthur this whole thing about Inyun and 8,000 layers and this and that. And he's like, you really believe that, you know, that this, that? And she's like, she kind of laughs at him. She's like, no, that's just something Koreans say to seduce someone. And he's like, oh. And I love from there, it's all body language, right? And it's standing in for dialogue, right? It's almost like he's saying, what, really? She's like, yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm seducing you right now. He's like, oh, okay. She's like waiting for him. Now she's giving him an opportunity to make a move. She's like waiting. She's like, yeah, are you gonna do it? Are you gonna be a chicken? And then he goes for it, which is awesome. It's all body language. And that kind of stuff is laced throughout the script. There's a moment whenever they're, I guess in grad school, and Nora gets a message back from, what's his face? Haesung. And she's in a study group or something. I don't even remember if this is in the film. But in the script, there's this great moment where she gets that message, and she's like texting him and she's smiling, and her study partner, looks up, and this is what it says in the script. Janice looks up, and in italics, what's up? Nora shrugs. In italics, nothing. And I love that way of communicating to the reader body language. Sometimes that's really tricky to write. How do you communicate things that we do instinctually, you know, in person? Because this is a visual medium, and yet you're having to write for a visual medium and finding ways to do that in a way that is flowing and allows the viewer to keep engaged and keep reading boom, boom, boom while seeing it. It's really tricky. It's an art. It really is an art. And just having a an italicized Janice looks up. What's up? Nora shrugs. Nothing. Yeah. As an actor, you know what that means. As a reader, you know what that means. It flows beautifully. The other thing that I really love reading this script, this could have been a 60-page script, but it would have betrayed the pacing of the film. And so through the screenwriting, she found a really smart way to build out the world that in a way that allows for pacing to be read on the page. And therefore you're not boring your reader, but you're also not speeding through the scenes, right? Because on the page, there's so little dialogue that if you just keep to the dialogue, you're going to zip in and out of these scenes thinking that this is a very fast film when it's not. This is a very slowly paced film. So you got to find ways to pace your reader to make them feel the weight of all these things that are happening. And sometimes it's pretty nonchalant. Like there's a scene in the film where that happens. It's like a 10-second scene where she's in New York and she's in school and this is where we're catching up 12 years have passed and she's in this writing group and this guy's giving her feedback. There's so much detail. And the thing that really stuck with me was the long journey of rotting. But prefacing that, there's like four small paragraphs that is just there leading into it. And it's just a nice way to eat up space on the page to give a sense of pacing. I won't read that one. But there's other things happening on the page that we would never know, especially as Americans, we would just never know that is there for other people who do. Like, if you're a Korean American, this movie is like tailor made for you. And I bet that's just a really cool experience. But even if you're Korean, there's probably stuff that's happening in here that is just for you. That's not going to be for Americans. And same thing, there's stuff happening as Americans that we wouldn't know is missing from a Korean watching the film. To them, it might be a little weird or just, you know, whooshes right over their head. They don't know. And so one of those things that I picked up that was cool was in the script that night when Hae-sung gets the message and he's with his buddies and they're just getting sloshed. And they're like, you got a secret girlfriend texting you at 3 a.m.? He's like, I don't know who this is. And he puts his phone back because he doesn't know who Nora Moon is yet. And in the morning, he wakes up and he's having breakfast and he's eating soup. And I remember watching this and I was like, what? Do they eat soup for breakfast? It was just very strange for me. But in the script, it points out Hae-sung's mom cooked a Korean hangover soup, spicy and rich meat broth with bean sprouts, for her hungover son. Like, this is a hangover, you know, treatment that his mom's taking. And that might be more obvious to you if you're Korean, whereas as Americans, we're like, "It's do they just eat soup for breakfast in Korea?"
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's layers. There's so many layers to this film. Another thing that I really like is, again, this goes back to finding ways to pace your scenes in a way that feels there embedded into the script as you're reading it. And I was broken reading this script. I felt all the same emotions I felt watching the film and was just welling up and snapping into at points. So it's just so, so good. One of those is whenever they're at the carousel and walking around downtown or through the boardwalk or whatever, and finding ways to break it up a little bit. And they're smiling at each other and then cut to them sitting in front of the carousel. And this is what it says. Exterior in front of Jane's carousel. Sunset. Some time has passed. The two of them sit in front of Jane's carousel, watching the sun fade away, listening to the sound of the water. They've run out of words for the moment. Long silence. Nora turns to look at Hae-sung. Hae-sung looks back at her. Nora. Hae-sung. Hmm? Why did you look for me? Hae-sung looks at Nora with a curious expression. When Nora turns to look at him, he doesn't smile. He just stares. 12 years ago? Yeah. You really want to know? Like, it's just a very... And she's also using Korean and English in the script.
Oh, cool.
And so she's embedding probably other little cultural touches for Korean readers who can pick up on that stuff. It's just really... Well, and that also adds to the runtime through the page. Because those are moments that you need for the reader to read the subtitle. So adding in the Korean within the script itself, one, probably acknowledge that she knows what she's doing. Like, if she's pitching this to A24 or whoever else, they buy into a little bit more. Oh, she knows what she's doing. She's not just some American who wants to tell a Korean story. She has some, you know, skin in the game. By writing in Korean, she gets to signal that. But then finding ways to break up the dialogue with motivations for the actors. Wonderful. Another little moment that happens that I thought is just so good. There's two of these that I'll read with Arthur. One is when she gets home from that first time hanging out with Hae-sung. Arthur's playing games, right? You could have just wrote Arthur's playing Xbox. But in the scene, she's getting home. She's processing, digesting before she says her first line. You need to say something that denotes there's time passing and where you just see it on the page, even if what she's writing doesn't really matter. And what she's writing, it doesn't matter necessarily to what will be shown, but it matters in a way that still gives Arthur something to build from his character. And this is what it says. Interior, Nora and Arthur's apartment, night. Nora gets home. Arthur is playing Overwatch on their Xbox One. He plays Zenyatta, a Zen Buddhist monk robot who heals and deals damage to his opponents and says things about the balance of the universe. Now, finally, Nora says her first line. Hi. Arthur says, hi, my love. Like, and now we can start the scene. Like, all that detail about Arthur playing Overwatch and who he's playing with, we don't know. We're never going to... That stuff is never going to show up on screen, right? Now, maybe she thought of a way to incorporate that, and maybe this was a conversation with her cinematographer. Chabier says, hey, this is cool, but we don't really want to show that, do we? Why not? Well, I don't know. Maybe Nora or Celine always knew this wasn't going to be in there. That would be my suspicion. But it gave a way to break up the page in a way that gave Arthur more details about who he is as a character. He plays a Zen Buddhist monk robot who's healing people.
Very him.
Very him. Absolutely. The other little thing that I liked is the way she used a few times parentheticals. I don't use this a lot in my writing, but there's a moment when they're in bed and you direct your actors on the page sometimes. I'm a little suspect of doing that too much. I like my actors to read it and find what they find. And if it's not where I want to go, I just kind of like, hey, let's actually think about it this way instead. Oh, I get it. Yeah. But sometimes it's obvious on the page, but you still give something else to your actor. And for her, this is a moment when they're in bed. He flew 13 hours to be here. This is Arthur. I'm not going to tell you you shouldn't see him or something. He's your childhood sweetheart, and it's not like you're going to run away with him. Nora laughs. Arthur, semi-seriously, are you? And Nora, and this is what she puts in parentheticals, deadpan, comma, LOL. Like, this is a joke. She's being deadpan, but this is all funny. Definitely, I'm going to throw away my life here and run away with him to Seoul. Like, that's a kind way to be like, you're joking with your husband, even though it probably would have been obvious on the page. But adding that extra little touch, it's fast, and it gives a little bit of the levity that you need so that you go into reading that dialogue with the understanding of what this is, as opposed to reacting to it and reconstructing it in your mind after the fact. So when you go in knowing this is a joke, you read it as a joke instead of reading it twice and saying, definitely, I'm going to throw away my life here. Oh, she's joking. Right. You get to the end of that sentence before you realize she's joking. But that parenthetical is a great way to signal to the reader, not to your actor. Your actor is going to know. But the reader now knows and reads it with the same levity. And it keeps them in tune with your script so that you're in a flow and you don't have to break and stop with understanding what is the tone of the scene. It's just really incredible writing. The last thing, I'm not going to read all this because it's outrageous, but the last thing is when that moment you pointed out, Todd, when Hae-sung finally meets Arthur and they walk in and Nora comes in and Arthur is kind of antsy in the background. Nora says, come in, and Hae-sung does. And this is the start of the script, that scene. Hae-sung does and naturally takes off his shoes at the door. Tense beat. Arthur takes in the view of his wife and her childhood sweetheart. And it's just another like, 4.5 paragraphs of description before Arthur finally gets to say, hello, it is nice to meet you, in his broken up Korean.
Wow.
And it's giving all that space for Arthur, for John Magaro to sit and exist and to take in everything that's happening. None of that is necessarily playable, but it's also, you know, he understands, I'm eating up a lot of time by soaking in my wife coming home with a dude.
Yeah.
And how do I react to that? Oh, yeah. I learned a lot from reading the script. And that's always the goal for me, is reading screenplays to get better at my craft and to see how other actors do it. Sometimes it's cribbing notes, like that idea of the parenthetical. I never would have thought to use it in that way to make sure I don't lose my reader, as opposed to I usually think of those things in terms of I'm giving notes to my actor, which is why I don't do it a lot as an actor. I don't like having overly directed scenes until I get a chance to feel it out for myself. And as a writer, I want to give that same opportunity. But as a writer, I need to make sure I'm also writing for people who aren't actors, who are needing to be in the flow and the rhythm. There's other things, the way that she uses text to break up and pace her work while giving context. The rule in screenwriting is usually don't write things that aren't filmable. She's just writing gobs and gobs of things that aren't filmable, but she's doing it in a way that fleshes out the world for the actors to have something to play against while using it as a method for pacing her scene. That's just, I learned a lot, man. This is it's a great read. If you want to, after watching this, walking out, I turn off the you know, music in the car on the way home. It's one of those films where I just really wanted to sit in it. If this were like a really good mustard sauce for a sandwich or something, I would just want a pool of that that I could go sit in. Like, it's just that kind of film for me. And so, you know, figuring out how that worked on the page was really satisfying. And if you're that same kind of person, you're like, I want to re-experience this movie for the first time, go read the screenplay. It's a great way to kind of get that same vibe where it feels a little fresh but familiar, and it's just really satisfying still. Yeah, man.
Where do you get your screenplays? Where do you see it? Did you just look it up?
Yeah, all over the place. Yeah, that's normally what I'll do. Sometimes it's on the writer's website because they're submitting it to like the Academy for award season. Mm-hmm. And so you can find it that way. And there's script websites out there for sure. Some of them are better than others, but and you always need to be wary about PDFs because that's kind of a broken format. You can get viruses and stuff on your laptop. Not a ton of that, I think, on Mac OS, but you know, just something to be aware of. Don't go on seedy sites. Look for something that looks semi-reputable. But yeah.
What does this script say about his book? It's called, titled Boner.
It's titled Boner.
Like, what? When I saw that, I was like, what am I looking at? What? And there's a balloon dog on the cover. Like, what is this? What does it say about that?
It does actually go into it a little bit. Here it is. Okay. Arthur is at a book signing of his own novel. We can see the cover of the book that says Boner by Arthur Zadaransky. He is talking to a couple hip younger women that are big fans. Nora approaches him, her face buried in her phone. She has his lunch, a bagel sandwich that she hands him. Arthur turns to Nora and gives her a quick thank you kiss, which Nora looks up from her phone to receive. I guess that's as far as they go with it. Yeah.
Okay.
But what's interesting too about that scene is they cut up, we don't see her get the kiss or hand him the bagel sandwich. They cut out of that pretty quick. And I think that's one of those, we're doing it for runtime. Like we get the sense Arthur is a decent author. I get what they're doing there. you also get a sense of the relationship that there's a casual and intimate thing that's happening at the same time. Bringing someone their lunch. That's cool. That's a loving gesture.
Yeah. Supportive.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's important. It establishes him as somewhat successful. So he's not like mooching off of her because we've seen her be successful as like, you know, in doing what she's doing. So we should see him as well to establish him as like a partner in this relationship. And she's supporting him by bringing him food. I think it does help with runtime for sure. But yeah,
it does. And man, the other thing I got really encouraged about is this script is so tight because there's nothing extraneous happening. You know, that's about as far as we get, as far as like extraneous scenes, right? Because we don't know anything about his book. We go there, we see that he's at a book thing, and that's it. Like, we don't get sidetracked into conversations about work, right? We never hear her talk about her plays. We see her working at workshops for 10 seconds at a clip, and then we're out. Everything in this movie is about Hae-sung and Na-young, and it's their relationship. And then we circle in Arthur, and then it's about their relationship, and that's it. It's very tightly focused, and for me, that's encouraging because there's always these temptations to go off on these tangents, and she just never does that. She allows the story to be the story.
Awesome.
And I love it for that, man. Yeah, final thoughts?
Agreed. Nope. I think I said everything I want to say. I love your insights into the script. So cool. So cool to see that. I don't have anything else. Great, great film. I can't wait to watch it again, honestly. Yes.
So glad. Jenny should watch it. She would just fall apart.
She would.
Because that last scene where she does, where, you know, Nora is holding it together at the goodbye, and then she walks slowly back to her house, and Arthur's out there. And he goes to her. He just holds her.
I totally did not expect that either. I didn't expect him to be waiting for her. Because, you know, he closes the door when she leaves to walk out. So I just thought, she's going to walk back alone. Nope. Walks back with him, holding her. So cool. Yeah.
So cool. Yeah. Nice. What are you going to recommend this week?
I failed.
Okay.
I didn't have anything. What are you going to recommend?
I'm going to recommend, if you like the cinematography here, there's one other film that I've watched from Xavier Kirchner. It's called Skate Kitchen. And I love this movie. It's very much the kind of film I would want to make because it's raw. It's much more raw and dirty than Past Lives in terms of cinematography, because it's very much slice of life of the skater kids in New York. So if you like New York stories, which I am obsessed with eternally, and this is it's a great one. It's just kids trying to figure out, you know, it's a coming of age thing with women, young women getting into skater culture, which is very boy dominated, right? And so how do these girls fit in as skaters? And it's all these interesting dynamics, and it's just wonderfully shot. It's 100% the kind of film I would want to shoot and make, and explore. God, it's good. The other thing while you're scrolling, the other thing I really loved about the story is Celine's song having a background as a playwright is always really interesting because it's so much easier to create characters. That's what playwrights do. It's always character first, character, character, character. And that's really cool as a starting point for a script. And so I want to study this more from that standpoint of it. At points, it definitely feels very theatric in terms of scene work and cinematography work. But that other aspect of inserting character as a starting point instead of backing your way into character through set pieces. That's what a lot of action films do. They say, why is the Transformer here? Well, it's because Optimus Prime wants... No. You say, here's a big set piece. How can we get Optimus Prime there? Okay, well, he needs to do X, Y, Z because this is Optimus Prime. And it's just very backwards, right? This is inside out instead of outside in. And that's where all these characters go and decide to do things. It's out of who they are. And that's what I mean by character driven. The other really amazing thing about this film is the score. And I heard, so I watched the A20 or listened to an A24 podcast with Celine Song, and she's talking about the score. And this is the only thing I can remember from that podcast, and I'll link it in the show notes. But she just talks about how the score reacts to the film. It doesn't push the film. And so, and that there's always a way to do this or that. And in this kind of film, I love that the score never asserts itself. It always reacts to the emotion, and you first earn the emotion. This is what she said. This is me making a good observation, but she said she wanted to make sure she earned the emotion first, and then the score would come in and support it, but always after the fact. And so you almost never realize when the score is there. It just suddenly is just, oh, how long has there been music? It's because you engaged emotionally first before the music came in and said, this is a beautiful moment and you're experiencing this thing now. And it's just a great way to tell a drama as opposed to horror films are different, right? You tell a horror film, you're foreshadowing through music a lot of times, and it's striking you and building suspense through intention through the score choices. Yeah.
Awesome. I love that approach. That's really cool. Make sure you got the emotion on the screen and then let the music follow that. So yeah, cool.
Very cool.
Okay. I do have a reco, something that I just kind of like stumbled upon this week, which I thought was pretty cool. It's a short film. It's a 7.5 minutes long called Portrait of God. It's by a filmmaker, named Dylan Clark. And it's cool. Have you seen it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you have. Okay. Yeah. It's cool because it's not what you think or expect. And it's not, yeah, it's just really cool. 7 minute thing that I think that anybody could film, really. And that's what's cool about it. It could be any, you could like it or not, it doesn't matter. The point is that it's something that anybody could make, and just with a little bit of creativity in a room, you know, kind of essentially. So
well done. Yeah, that's a wonderful film. So we'll embed that into the show notes and enjoy. Yeah, stay tuned for next week. We take a look at Alex Garland's next and, you know, potentially last film, because he's saying he might retire, which I don't for one second believe. But he's saying he's going to focus on screenwriting, which I would be okay with if it meant more works by Alex Garland, because you can hammer out a script in, you know, 3 to 6 months as opposed to 2 years to make a film. And so we'll cover Civil War and see what, you know, fun rom-com he's cooked up for us there. And if you're enjoying the show, don't forget, drop us a review and subscribe. If you want to leave a comment on this episode, you can do that at thepestlepodcast.com/pastlives.
And our quote of the day is from Jimmy Carter. We become not a melting pot, but a beautiful mosaic. Different people, different beliefs, different yearnings, different hopes, different dreams. Wow. Yeah, it's beautiful. Like such, so well put. I never thought of the difference between the two, honestly, till reading that.
Because we're all together. Yeah, I love that. It is something to celebrate, and I do. I love, like, I don't want to get all political here, so I'll just say, like, I love that's what America broadly still stands for. Despite whatever else is happening, I think people still want to come here because of everything that comment represents. And I love it.
Yeah, and I mean, the difference between a melting pot and a mosaic. A mosaic is individual things making up a greater whole. So we all still remain individual, but a melting pot is like just everything becomes, you know, this conglomerate of everything else. And that's definitely not who we are. We are all individuals. And yeah, such a beautiful quote. Man, I never thought of that. I love quotes that make you, that like say something that you already know, but you know, but in a way that you've never heard it before. It's so cool.
Ditto. Nice. Yeah. Well done.
Great. Wow. What an episode. I thought this was going to be shorter. I
did
told
too.
My wife,
honestly,
I was like, don't worry.
The intro.
Don't worry. This is not going to be 2 hours. She's like, yeah, you can, you know, you can control that. I'm like, yeah, I know. But apparently I can't. hopefully you guys enjoyed it. I would love to hear what you think. Give us your comments and review us wherever you can. Subscribe, all that stuff. It really helps. Share us with your friends. It really helps. And if there's a film that you'd like to see us pick apart, please make a recommendation. Who knows? Maybe we'll cover it. Until next time, I'm Todd.
I'm Wes.
Go watch some movies.